outside of the state, outside of all these colonial binaries, even in gender and sexuality, and also in regards to joy and pleasure and imagination, and that we need that, and that we need more mutual aid, we need community, we need a collective life, and that we need to keep defending life outside of a materialized form that has been imposed to us.
Oh, Yoali, thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Ayana.
Thank you for listening to this episode of For the Wild podcast. The music you heard today is by Eliza Eden, Fabian Almazan Trio, and Paloma. For the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Ali Constantine, Erica Ekram, Emily Guerra, and Julia Jackson.
KBOO on Wednesday, October 5th for Dead Moon Night,
a four-hour extravaganza
celebrating the 2017 event when 1,100 rockers showed up outside Portland City Hall
to commemorate the legendary band Dead Moon in an official city proclamation of October 5th as Dead Moon Night.
Again, that's Dead Moon Night, Wednesday, October 5th, from 8 p.m. till midnight.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, brave Iranian women in the streets and on their bikes risking their life for freedom and basic human rights. We'll have a special report. Also, the Election Crimes Bulletin returns with Greg Palast, fighting the good fight for your right to vote. Greg is poised in Atlanta for the release of his new film, Vigilante, Georgia's vote suppression hitman. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Coming up just a little bit later on in the broadcast, we will be speaking with Greg Palast. He's in Atlanta. He's been spending a lot of time in Georgia, where one of the key battles for the future of this country is going to come down to what happens in the next election. So you don't want to miss that. But first, we're going to start with Iran and what's going on in Iran, and the kind of, I guess, bravery and courage and commitment we've now seen with women, young women, and other supporters taking on and demanding that they be brought into the 21st century and have the rights that everybody else has or wants to have in this world. And certainly, if you're a woman in Iran, you don't have. Joining us is somebody who is, her name is Ari. She is an Iranian woman. She was exiled. Ari, welcome to Flashpoints. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and say a little bit about the wonderful program you work on, Rumi with a View, Cultural Bridges Across War-Torn Borders?
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Dennis. Yes, so I'm from Shiraz, Iran originally, and when I was 6 years old, women of Iran lost their right to ride a bicycle or sing in public. And women's rights were cut in half under a strict interpretation of the Sharia law, which was implemented after the Islamists took over post-revolution Iran and implemented their draconian methods. My work here is building cultural bridges across war-torn and conflict-ridden borders. I have a dance program with refugees. I'm bringing what was denied to me as a child in Iran, which was singing and dancing, to refugees as a way of healing now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on. I know it's been frustrating for you and many people who are trying to get information, understand, share information as well. It's hard to get through. The internet is certainly not free on the ground in Iran at this point. But talk to us as much as you can. It's an amazing thing to see these young women standing up, but talk to us about what you've been able to learn and what's going on through your mind as somebody who is, obviously, I'm sure there's a part of you that's there on the ground in the middle of all this, even as you watch from afar.
Mm-hmm. So just said a little bit of a background. I wrote a piece for Vice a couple of years ago about how fashion always being used as a weapon for the resistance movement in Iran. And for the past 4 decades, women have used subversive methods of resistance because the way our rights were cut in 1979 never sat right with us. Our sense of justice and fairness wouldn't accept how we lost our civil liberties so unceremoniously and so abruptly. So it doesn't matter how young we were, we would fight. Like when I was a kid, I cut my hair and pretended to be a boy to enjoy the same freedoms as my best friend who was 10 years old. But now these women, these courageous young people in Iran are showing what they're showing. The courage that they're showing is absolutely astounding. First of all, I should mention that 60% of the Iranian population is under the age of 30. They've never known anything but oppression by a fundamentalist regime, and they're absolutely sick of it. Girls are ripping off their hijab and going right to the morality police, to these men with shields, batons, and guns, knowing full well that they'll be beaten or even killed. They're engaging in beautiful acts of civil disobedience, singing, dancing, going hijabless, cutting their hair out in public. There's even a photo of two women sitting at a restaurant without their hijab. And soon after posting the photo, one of the young women was arrested. But it so reminds me of the sit-ins of the 1960s civil rights movement here in the U.S. and the photos of black people sitting at the lunch counter of restaurants. It's a similar act of disobedience. You know, for them, it was being refused to serve by white people. For women of Iran, it's just having the same right as a man.
Could you talk a little bit more about what you think is sort of the responsibility, say, of folks watching this from afar in other countries? What is Iran has had a very special relationship with the United States, certainly not a close relationship. There are a lot of issues that complicate the story, but say a little bit more about the history and where your hope lies in this. I mean, it is amazing to see so much courage expressed in such a public way. What do you think might come next? Will the morality police disappear? It seems like the women are pushing it, are really pushing the envelope and doing a little bit more and a little bit more. Where is it going?
Yeah, so it's women and it's men too. So everyone is in this together. Men are putting their bodies in front of women as shields. They're standing right by them. They're composing songs and getting arrested because they also are fighting for women's rights. So it's not just women are definitely leading the way, but they have support from their fellow human beings there, whatever gender that they are. So for the international community to watch this from afar, what they are desperate for, what they're asking people on the ground in Iran is to amplify their voice. There is internet blackouts in Iran. The regime is cracking down on social media, but luckily people are super resourceful, these young people are resourceful and they have VPNs and they're able to get around that somewhat and get the news out, that they need so much more support to amplify their voices. Anyone who fights for feminism, for civil rights, for social justice, intersectionality, this is your time to step up and amplify Iranian people's voices.
Are you interested in going back to Iran? Someday, are you inspired? Do you think there'll be a time when you'll feel safe to go home?
So the last time I went back to Iran was in 2000, and I was, arrested at the airport. So it was I was interrogated for hours and hours before they let me go, and it was completely. And the thing that actually made them let me go was something about the hijab, because when I went back, I didn't have my Islamic attire, and what I had was a graduation gown that from, when I had graduated from college. And it was one of those things where it fits the Islamic requirements, but it was certainly odd. And they saw that and they pulled me out and they asked if I wore a similar thing in the U.S. And what I said was, oh yeah, I have a black one that I wear on odd days and a navy one that I wear on even days. And I said that, I don't know why, I was just shocked, and I made a joke and they laughed and they let me go. So that was my experience of going back to Iran, and this was before I even started speaking out against the regime. Seeing everything that is happening right now, I absolutely I have a strong desire. My heart is in Iran. I want to go back to there, but I don't think I will be much help if they arrest me at the airport, and that's that. So I'll do what I can here from this vantage point to get as much support for my people on the ground.
And I guess you don't have much use or much belief in what the police are saying about the killing that really lit the latest match on this fury. The Iranians are saying that they're, telling a whole different story. I guess that's not something that people in the street are listening to.
Yeah, I mean, it's very highly, highly unlikely that their story is true, that Mahsa Amini, the young woman who they arrested and later was in a coma and died in the hospital, didn't suffer torture or beatings and just had a heart attack or had some sort of a medical issue. Even if on the very, very small percent chance that this is true, they're still killing people who are protesting police brutality. They're using police brutality to kill people who are protesting police brutality. So that by itself shows the world what kind of people we're dealing with.
All right, before we let you go, could you say a little bit more about your organization, Rumi, with the View? I love that. I am a big fan of Rumi. I get my best news stories from the 15th century. I love the title. Honestly, I'm not kidding. Rumi with a View, Cultural Bridges Across War-Torn Borders. Tell us about what you're doing in that group. Say a little bit more about
that. Yes. So I have a few things. One is Draw Poem, Not Bombs, which musicians of American musician learn a line of poetry in Farsi, a line of Rumi's poetry in Farsi, and sing it back as a love letter to the people of Iran. That's one of the projects. I'm a musical ambassador of peace, and I conduct dance sessions with Syrian, Afghan, Iranian, and Central and South American refugees and Ukrainian refugees as a way of healing and connecting them back to their roots. And I work with Gente Unida, which is a San Diego-based organization, nonprofit, focusing on migrant children. And this past weekend, I had a session. I have a weekly session, and I dance with 300 refugees in Tijuana. And they surprised me at the end of the session, and they all held their hands and shouted together in Spanish, "We stand with the people, with the women of Iran. Estamos con las mujeres de Iran." And they said that, and I just started crying.
Nice. Really nice.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. Go on.
No one understands the intersectionality of social justice better than those who fled unimaginable violence. If they can do it, it shows that we all can have more than one cause in our hearts.
Yeah. Boy, I really like that. That's a good note to finish on, except that I'd like you to give a website or ways that people can get in touch with you.
Sure, I'm at RumiWithAView.com.
RumiWithAView.com. I love that title. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again soon. Be safe.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dennis.
You're welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And guess what, everybody? Our good friend, our investigative reporter, MacGregor Greg Palast, is in Georgia, in Atlanta, I believe, for the opening of his new film. And, well, it's time for the Election Crimes Bulletin with Greg Palast in Georgia. Listen.
This whole election is being rigged. The election is being rigged.
It's totally rigged.
Yes, Donald, it's rigged because your cronies rigged it.
So says Rolling Stone investigative reporter Greg Palast.
You're removing black voters from the voter rolls just so you can win this election?
We will treat those people from January 6th fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons.
So you didn't call him, but you challenged his right to vote or have his ballot challenged.
Sir, get out of my house.
Okay, I will get out of your house.
House.
I just...
Now.
It's now time for your Election Crimes Bulletin with Greg Palast.
Let's tell him if there's no link to call my cell phone. Six, get in the cell phone.
What was that number? You're listening to... Okay, you're listening to the Election Crimes Bulletin. And Greg, did I lie or are you in Atlanta? Did they let you back in the city?
Well, I had to wear a wig over my hat, so
I guess that's a tough fit. But you know, you've definitely weaseled your way into all kinds of strange corners to find out the information we need. But you are in Atlanta now.
Yes, I'm in Atlanta with here with our investigator par excellence and photographer Zach D. Roberts, who's joined me. He's been on with you before. And by the way, yep. Lashana Tova, is that correct for the holiday today? And
something like that.
I'm in Atlanta. I'm sorry. I'm in Atlanta because, well, I'm still investigating what Brian Kemp, the governor, is up to in terms of not, you know, he does allow black people to ride bicycles and sing in the street, just not vote. And I'm not kidding about this. We, Brian Kemp, signed a law, SB 202, which prohibits, which is blocking over 250,000 voters of color and young people from voting in the general election, which is coming up, the rematch between Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams. There's also a down-to-the-wire match, a complete dead heat between Herschel Walker and Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock. So we keep returning to Georgia after 9 years because it's here in Georgia that the GOP test drives its vote suppression trickery. I know we use the polite phrase vote suppression, but come on, Dennis. Someone steals your car, you don't say, my car has been suppressed. It's been stolen. So we've seen this extraordinary fight back. The reason I was happy to bring in Zach here into Atlanta and on this conversation today is that he was able through his particular methods, we can't give them all away, but able to get on camera one of the vigilantes under this new law. Any Georgia citizen can challenge an unlimited number of other voters. And Zach was able to get a hold of one vigilante. He dresses like a vigilante. He's chairman of the Muskogee Republican Party at the county in Columbus, Georgia, at Fort Benning, where this gentleman has challenged 4,000 voters. It looks like most of them are African American soldiers assigned from Fort Benning, working at Fort Benning, and so they've left the state because they've been so assigned because of the military, and now their votes have been challenged. And so we have him on camera in a film called Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman, which will have a special world impact preview premiere tomorrow here in Atlanta with the NAACP, Black Voters Matter, Georgia Coalition for the People's Agenda, that's Reverend Lowry's organization. And we'll have the soldier himself, whose vote was challenged by this vigilante, who likes to dress like a vigilante, like Doc Holliday. He has he carries a six shooter for his little performances.
Is it loaded?
Get to meet him in our film.
Is it loaded?
He's loaded.
Be careful.
Literally shows up with bullets.
What the heck happened there? I didn't book that bullet in there.
His gun is loaded, I should say. In the film, this is important to get an idea. Like, you have to understand, well, if someone's voting who's not a Georgian, they shouldn't vote in Georgia. It is a federal crime and a state crime. But what he did was he challenged all these black soldiers and saying that they didn't live where they live. So we invited him to a home to put on his little vigilante performance, literally, with his six guns and his cowboy hat. And he was at the home without realizing it. I said, you know where you are? No. Well, would you like to meet your host, the owner of this home? And Major Gamaliel Turner, the U.S. military's expert on warfare of the future, fancy title, warfare of the future, Gamaliel Turner welcomed into his house. And I said, do you know that you have challenged this soldier's right to vote? You said he didn't live in this house, in the house you are in right now, in his home. And you'll see this in the film, Vigilante Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman, which is premiering tomorrow night in Wednesday night in Atlanta. There's a couple seats left because we just got a bigger theater. It was sold out, but we've expanded it. The major will be there. The leaders of the NAACP, Gerald Griggs, the famous trial attorney who's now head of the NAACP, will be there. And then we're going to take it on the road to a couple special places. One is the Bay Area, which will be on the 19th, Wednesday, the 19th of October at the Grand Lake Theater. We'll talk about that later. And I'm also going to Chicago. The Reverend Jesse Jackson has asked me to come to Chicago Tuesday, next Tuesday on the 11th, and then to Minneapolis on the 12th. And we'll be taking these around the country. But the important thing, Dennis, is that we are exposing a new system, and they always take these things out for a test drive in Georgia. This new challenge system, which is now spread to Iowa, Texas, Michigan, Wisconsin, and we are confronting these vigilante voters, exposing this system. And I have to say, I want to report a bit of news. Zach D. Roberts and I were at the Gwinnett County Elections Board last night. 37,000 voters in Gwinnett, almost all of them African Americans, 37,000 voters in Gwinnett were challenged by GOP operatives, and they turned out in force last night. But the elections board of Gwinnett County being told you have to knock out 37,000 voters with virtually, you know, there's like no evidence. And they voted 3-2 to say, no, we're going to ignore these challenges. This is a direct attack on people's rights to vote. That was a courageous, courageous position by the Elections Board of Gwinnett County. It's shocking that two members of the board actually wanted to stop these 37,000 voters. But that's a big victory. But I have to say, Dennis, it could be temporary. The reason is that under the new law signed by Governor Kemp, he has the power to yank members of elections boards which don't accept these challenges. And that ain't just an idle threat. He's removed already the woman known as Mrs. Vote in Georgia. Like, the number one expert on voting in Georgia is named Helen Butler. She's head of the, she's African American. And she was removed from the Morgan County Elections Board on the grounds that she literally asked questions. Zach, you, tell us about that, about Helen Butler, her removal. Oh, he's shaking his head. He wants me to.
Zach, are you there? You're right.
He's there, but he's a little.
Let me
bit
just
away
say
from the
that. Let me bring Zach in here. A reporter working with Greg Palast, who's really been on the front line and putting his life on the line to photograph and to sort of document the emergence of this extreme right-wing movement that we now see on trial in New York, in Washington, D.C., but taking power, as Greg was just saying, in terms of really undermining the very system by which we elect our politicians, our leaders. Zach, tell us about your story and why you're a maniac enough to try and photograph these folks.
So, I mean, this is a story that I've covered across several states. I spent a lot of time in Pennsylvania. Obviously, spent quite a bit of time in Georgia. I keep joking that I probably could apply for residency here at this point.
You could. But,
I'm not going to try. Don't worry. You know, Raffensperger and the vigilantes. No, I'm not going to try that. What I have been seeing is that these two groups of people, the vigilantes, these supposedly self-taught vigilantes that are doing the job that Brian Kemp used to do, doing the job that the Republican Party used to do through massive voter purges, they're taking it upon themselves to do things like Google searching people's residency records and their home loans. There's a whole bunch of basically part-time real estate agents that have the access and ability to look up where people own homes. And, you know, if you own a second home in South Carolina and you live in Georgia, they're going to go, well, you know, very clearly, it's a different, they're voting in two different spots. And that's all the record. And that's all the record that they need. They just photocopy, they just print that out and they send in the PDFs. And we have thousands of these documents. I've been toying every county I can possibly go through to get these documents, and we're finding thousands across the state. But what I'm seeing in especially in Pennsylvania and even in Georgia, that and we saw in 2020 with the Stop the Steal movement, is that the militias and the right wing, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, especially, are working hand in hand. They're the armed side, and then these guys are just armed with their cell phones, filming every moment they possibly can. And that's something we saw in Gwinnett when we had a conversation with one of the biggest in the state. We won't release her name right now, but who has been doing tens of thousands of these and leading and training other people with just a little bit too much time on their hands to work to purge their fellow Georgians from being able to do the only thing the least thing that you should be able to do as an American, which is vote.
Yeah, and I should mention.
So you can essentially purge by zip code.
You can do is you have to understand these are vigilantes. Under Georgia law, this new Georgia law, any voter So it's not the government removing voters, though they're doing that en masse. It's been horrible this year in Georgia. Horrendous. They've removed hundreds of thousands of voters. But after the massive removal by the state, then these GOP operatives, and all of them are GOP operatives, all of them are GOP officials at the top level, the bottom level, they then add in their own tens of thousands of challenges after the purges have been made. And that's a point that was made by a couple of the election supervisors who said, no, they said, look, we've already removed tens of thousands of people that the state, hundreds of thousands of people that the state told us to remove. And now you're saying that the state, that Brian Kemp himself missed these illegal voters? Yeah. And by the way, not one, it's very, very important to understand, Brian Kemp has removed over 500,000 voters in his career. He's arrested dozens. He has fired elections officials all on the grounds that there's massive voter fraud. He's demanded, as we speak, that the Attorney General charge Reverend Warnock, their own senator, with the felony crime of ballot tampering, because an organization that he was once chairman of, I can't make this up, sent in registration forms, he claims, 2 days late. They are demanding that the Reverend Senator and members of the New Georgia Project be charged by the Attorney General of the state with a felony crime that would land them a minimum of 10 years in prison. I can't make this stuff up, Dennis. And so this whole new vigilante challenge, understand where it originated from. It originated with the Ku Klux Klan in 1946, which began these vigilante challenges. It was moribund. Brian Kemp put it into cyberspace where people are handing in thumb drives with thousands of names of people that they don't want to vote. And those people now, like the major, had to fly 2,600 miles to save his vote. This is what's going on in Georgia, and it's spreading.
Wow. Zach, can you hear me, Zach?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Just say a little bit more. We're going to have to break, but just say a little bit more about the people. You know, just a few details about the people you've been photographing that you know tells the whole story. Because there's nothing like being on site with your camera, looking, you know, 1 inch away to get an idea of who these people are. So just give us a sense, because we've been talking on this show for some time now about the emerging violence. You guys nailed it down initially in Atlanta, and it's only gotten worse. It's clearly out of control. The feds don't have a clue about what to do about it. But tell us who you met, who these people. You know, how you can describe these folks to us.
I mean, these are people who have been irreparably broken by the big lie. They believe in their core, in their heart, that they are doing the American justice. Just like the people, I mean, this is the new system that, you know, that the right wing is trying to have, whether it be a woman trying to get an abortion, whether it be a trans person trying to get help at a children's hospital or something, and they sick their minions after them. And that's who they are. But they all think that they're doing good. None of them think that they're trying to stop people. Every single person you talk to, no, we're not trying to stop anyone from voting. We're just trying to, you know, make sure that the people aren't voting twice or people aren't. But the moment you ever ask them, you go, hey, have you ever caught anybody who voted twice? No, not a single person. Never have. And I've talked to dozens across at least two different states. And a lot of times they believe I've gone undercover and they believe that I'm one of them. I've spent quite a bit of time on their behind the scenes on their Zoom phone calls and how they're meeting together. I actually went into a meeting where one of the women who is in our film spoke to me straight to my face just a couple months after we did a big confrontation, and she kicked both Greg and I out of her home. She spoke right to my face and said, "Say, what's your name?" And I told her one of my names. She was like, "Well, it's good to meet you. Good to see younger people coming out." So
But Zach is very good at doing the undercover thing, though it has been dangerous. He's been beaten by the right wing and the police, but sometimes those are the same thing. But yeah, so Zach has assigned all the really dangerous stuff. This is no kidding. He really has been beaten pretty severely and equipment ruined. So, I do appreciate it. Of course, he took those famous pictures in Charlottesville when the teacher was beaten nearly to death. That was Zach's photos that were on the front page of all the papers around the world, up from Charlottesville on the front page, even of the New York Times. But I have to say,
the
Times did not send in their photographers to be beaten. That's the assignment of the Palace investigative team. And I actually have to hold back.
You're proud of this, Greg?
I don't want to remove the bullets from him. This is one thing we do.
I got a discount bulletproof vest. Don't worry. My mom bought it for me.
He does have a bulletproof vest. Right.
Special. Oh. Combat plan. I get it. All right, listen, we're going to have to take a short break. And we're going to, some of you are going to hear us talk more, and others are going to hear the last part of the very powerful documentary, The Man Card. Stay with us.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race. CNN projects Donald Trump wins the presidency.
This was an earthquake unlike any earthquake I've really seen since Ronald Reagan in 1980. It just came out of nowhere.
It's been what they call a historic event.
In 2016, Donald Trump pulled off one of the greatest upsets in American political history, defying both polls and pundits.
Help me God.
So help me God.
Two explanations for his shocking victory dominated media coverage. One was economic and class anxiety.
The Clinton campaign could see white working class voters going to Trump in places like Iowa and Ohio.
The other was racial and cultural anxiety.
This was a white lash against a changing country.
We try to find these voters who are economic anxiety voters, but that is not what it is, Wolf. What it is it's cultural anxiety.
While both explanations were legitimate, they only told part of the story. Yes, Trump won the white vote by a large margin, but a closer look inside the numbers revealed that it was white men, in particular, who were most responsible for Trump's success. Trump not only won big with college-educated and upper-class white men, he won with a record-setting margin with white working-class men as well, clearly captivated by Trump's throwback tough guy persona.
Get him out of here. Throw him out.
Excuse me, sit down. You weren't called. Sit down. Sit down.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
But contrary to conventional wisdom, his impressive showing with white men didn't come out of nowhere.
We will make America great again.
We will make America great again.
Trump's wild popularity with men across class lines marked the culmination of a political shift that's been more than a half century in the making.
USA! USA!
A shift that's seen more and more working-class white men abandon the Democratic Party for a political movement that has routinely undercut their economic interests, yet clearly spoken to their emotional identities and longings as men.
So it isn't enough just to be a good president. You have to look like a good president.
Well, I think looking, obviously, and appearance is very important, but it's also staging, how you stage the message. It's a game, Barbara.
Anything that is actually masculine anymore is now a stick to be beat.
Real men do not suck at the of big government.
The left has culturally tried to feminize this country in a way that is disgusting.
I'm gonna bomb the out of them.
Hi, go home to mommy. Go home.
come to mommy.
Donald Trump is a cliche of old-fashioned masculinity.
The era of the pajama boy is over, and the alpha males are back.
And a lot of people long for that kind of masculinity, which is never coming back.
You see blue-collar voters, men. This is like their last vestige, their last hope is Donald Trump to get their masculinity back.
The man card is the card that Trump is playing. He is appealing to men.
The American presidency was conceived from the start as a white male institution. For roughly the first 100 years of the nation's existence, only white men had the right to vote. And although black men were formally, if not in practice, granted the right in 1870, women would still be barred from voting for another half century. With this as the foundation, it doesn't come as a surprise that all 45 U.S. presidents have been men, or that 44 of those 45 have been white men, or that only 3 women have even been nominated for the vice presidency. To this day, the symbolism we equate with the presidency is linked in the American imagination with traditional ideas around manhood. The President of the United States is the CEO of the most powerful nation on earth, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the father figure and protector from threats both foreign and domestic. This is clearly one of the many reasons women have had such a hard time gaining traction in American presidential politics.
And do you think in any way that the Soviets might be tempted to try to take advantage of you simply because you are a woman?
Women not only have to overcome the deeply sexist and unfounded assumption that men are somehow tougher than they are, they also have to find ways to live up to the masculine mystique that surrounds the presidency without coming across as too unlikable. But what's received far less attention is the profound impact ideas around manhood have played in shaping the presidential campaigns of male candidates as well, especially since the 1960s, when male power and authority started to come under attack, and American presidential politics began to emerge as a key staging ground in the larger crisis of white masculinity. The story begins with 2 seemingly unconnected cultural events, the Urban Riots of 1968 and the Hard Hat Riots of 1970. Both involve an immensely important figure in late 20th century American politics, Republican Richard Nixon.
This is a nation of laws, and as Abraham Lincoln has said, no one is above the law, no one is below the law, and we're going to enforce the law, and Americans should remember that if we're going to have law.
Nixon won the presidency in 1968 in a campaign that emphasized law and order. In a country roiled by social unrest and urban riots, and shaken by the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Democratic presidential candidate Bobby Kennedy. Historians now regard the 1960s as a pivotal era of uprisings in reaction to deeply entrenched systemic racism and injustice. But the 60s also gave rise to a political backlash that continues to this day. With violent crime on the rise and cultural norms being openly challenged, Nixon was able to harness the fear, anxiety, and anger of white middle-class America and position himself as the kind of strong man and tough leader the nation needed to defend the status quo.
Let us recognize that the first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence. So I pledge to you, we shall have order in the United States.
Nixon's media advisor was none other than Roger Ailes, one of the first people to recognize the transformative power of television in American politics. A future campaign advisor to several Republican presidents, right up through Donald Trump, he would go on to found the Fox News Channel, forever altering the political media landscape. Ailes was adept at whipping up white fears of urban crime, painting Democrats as too weak and soft to deal with it, and positioning conservative Republicans as the only ones capable of making Americans, especially white women, safe again.
Freedom from fear is a basic right of every American. We must restore it.
In May of 1970, in what came to be known as the Hard Hat Riots, an angry crowd of white construction workers attacked an anti-war protest march in New York City. A march in response to the killing of four students at Kent State University at the hands of National Guardsmen. The Hard Hat Riots revealed a growing split in the Democratic Party. Not only over the increasingly divisive Vietnam War, but between college-educated people with more liberal attitudes towards racial and gender equality and the more socially conservative white working class.
I'm a little sick of watching these kids burn a flag, and I know a lot of guys went over and didn't come back. And I don't like it. I'm here to say I love the flag.
We're in support of Nixon.
To the Nixon camp, this divide was political gold. The Republicans could position themselves as allies of blue-collar workers, along with the brave young men off fighting for the American way of life in Vietnam.
The leaders of the construction unions were invited to the White House, where they presented President Nixon with an honorary hard hat. And the hard hat became a symbol for the so-called silent majority, those who felt their way of life was now under siege.
For decades, going back to FDR's New Deal in the 1930s and the height of the labor movement, working-class white men had been rock-solid Democrats, union men, and wouldn't have dreamed of voting Republican. A party that had been long identified with greedy business owners and out-of-touch elites, hostile to the interests of labor and the average working man. But in the late 60s, the Democrats' long-standing image as the party of the white working class began to change, thanks in part to Nixon's mobilization of the politics of white grievance. White voters, especially in the South, had started to flee the Democratic Party after President Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964. And Nixon and the Republican Party would take advantage, capitalizing on the anxieties and resentments of growing numbers of white voters, especially white men, who experienced the struggle for equality as a threat to their cultural centrality. As presidential aide Patrick J. Buchanan said to Nixon, "These are our people now." In 1972, facing mounting public opposition to his prosecution of the war in Vietnam, Nixon ran for re-election against South Dakota Democratic Senator George McGovern, a liberal who opposed the war. Nixon and his handlers had paid close attention to the electoral success of former Alabama Governor George Wallace, a longtime Southern Democrat who ran for president as an independent in 1968.
They ignored us and looked down their nose at us and called us everything under the sun. And I'm sick and tired of it, and I resent it.
Wallace had found a way to speak directly to the racial and class grievances and resentments of white working class Southerners. Picking up nearly 10 million votes, he won five Southern states and ran surprisingly strong in parts of the North. Nixon immediately recognized how valuable Wallace's strategy could be to the Republican Party and his own re-election bid. He knew Republicans couldn't promise white working people better wages or benefits. That would hurt the profits of the plutocrats who controlled the Republican Party. Instead, he would give them the greatest gift of all, cultural recognition. With the help of speechwriter Pat Buchanan, Nixon invoked the silent majority, hardworking Americans being left behind in the wake of seismic demographic and societal changes.
So tonight, to you, the great silent majority, my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
Nixon championed this so-called forgotten man, the regular Joe, in distinct contrast to the supposed elitism of liberals like McGovern. By any measure, McGovern was far from an elitist. In fact, he was a longtime champion of organized labor and a progressive populist who supported lunch bucket economic policies that were popular with white working class voters. But his liberal stance on social issues and his popularity with anti-war, civil rights, and women's rights advocates rendered him vulnerable to attacks from the Nixon camp. McGovern's opposition to the war in Vietnam and his support of amnesty for draft evaders made it especially easy for Republicans to portray him as weak. It didn't matter that McGovern was a decorated fighter pilot in World War II, To his conservative detractors, he represented a liberal Democratic Party that had not only grown soft, but also seemed to care more about the struggles of women and people of color than the struggles of ordinary blue-collar white men. In 1972, Nixon won re-election with 66% of the white male vote on the way to a historic 49-state landslide, with a message that centered upon traditional ideas about manhood that clearly resonated with white women as well. Democrats, in turn, were handed a sobering message, a message that would resonate for the next half century. A failure to appear strong on the military or tough on law and order would be viewed as a reflection not only of their political priorities, but on their manhood. In the 1960s, Ronald Reagan seemed to walk onto the American political stage straight from central casting. And in a way, that's exactly what he'd done. Reagan had made his name in the 1950s as a TV host, commercial pitchman, and B-movie star with an affinity for cowboy roles. At the time, John Wayne was Hollywood's biggest star and was cementing his status as the archetypal American tough guy. And Reagan, following suit, did his best to project the same aura as an actor.
You wanted law and order in this town. You got it. And you're going to keep on having it as long as I'm marshal.
When he eventually made the transition to politics as governor of California, Reagan borrowed from the same script, helping to consolidate the growing right-wing backlash against the anti-war movement and counterculture in the process.
Here, a small minority of beatniks, radicals, and filthy speech advocates have brought shame on a great university.
I am sick and tired of the argument about whether some effort to enforce law and order is going to escalate anything at all. Plain truth of the matter is this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday. And it's going to be stopped, whatever it takes.
2 decades later, Reagan would ride his reputation as the John Wayne of American politics straight to the White House. In 1980, under Democratic President Jimmy Carter, the Iranian hostage crisis had humiliated the country, oil prices had skyrocketed, and the nation was mired in a deep recession. And Republicans placed the blame squarely on Carter, charging him and his party with breeding dependence on the nanny state and being too soft to lead in a dangerous world. In the height of the Cold War, many feared that the folksy Carter, who epitomized the introspective, sensitive, new man of the 1970s, was no match for violent adversaries like Soviet communists and Muslim terrorists. Enter Reagan, in full cowboy mode, to save the day.
Rolling, please. Let me know when you have speed.
Speed.
And
Galloway, Galloway.
You're the only movie actor I know of who ever got elected to a high office. Do you learn anything as an actor that has been useful to you as president?
Well, I'm tempted to say something here, but I'm going to say it.
Go ahead.
There have been times in this office when I've wondered how you could do the job if you hadn't been an actor.
Although Reagan's acting chops allowed him to create the illusion of authenticity, cowboy toughness, and blue-collar manliness, in reality, he was a charter member of California's country club elite. But he knew how to read a script, had already rehearsed the part, and had media-savvy handlers adept at crafting an image ordinary American guys could relate to. And the need for an actor of Reagan's talents made sense, given the reality of the policies being sold to the public. For years, conservatives have been pushing to cut Medicare, Social Security, and other government programs designed to aid working class and poor Americans, while calling for massive increases in military spending, deeply unpopular tax cuts for the rich, and a radical rollback of government regulations, workers' protections, and union power to maximize corporate profits at all costs. As the new front man for the cause, Reagan's handlers knew it was critical to dig deep into the mythology of American TV and movie culture and portray him as a salt of the earth, working class, man of the people. It was a throwback persona that would also serve Reagan well in advancing the agenda of another driving force of the newly ascendant conservative movement, white evangelical Christians.
In America, we
Evangelicals were less interested in making Wall Street and corporate America rich than in rolling back the dramatic gains achieved by the women's and gay liberation movements on reproductive rights, workplace discrimination, domestic violence, and many other fronts. Throughout the 1970s, the Democratic Party had aligned itself with feminists and gay rights advocates on issue after issue. In response, white evangelicals mobilized like never before and went to work on Republicans in Congress.
Moral Majority is not a religious organization. The fact is that it's political. It's a very political organization, and one's membership is based upon citizenship in this country and a commitment to a pro-life, pro-traditional family, pro-moral, and pro-American position.
In many ways, the evangelical movement's aim was to restore traditional, straight, white male authority. These so-called values voters were particularly alarmed by Supreme Court rulings and legislation that expanded opportunities for women to succeed outside the home, which they saw as a threat not only to men's status as head of the household, but to the stability of the patriarchal order itself. And their success in driving the Republican Party to the right on these issues was unmistakable. In just one of many examples, in 1971, more than 90% of House and Senate Republicans supported the Equal Rights Amendment, which, if adopted, would have granted women full rights in the Constitution. But by 1978, almost 70% of Republicans opposed it. And after their success pushing Congress to the right, all that remained was the presidency. And they found their man in Ronald Reagan.
Now, I know this is a nonpartisan gathering, and so I know that you can't endorse me, but I only brought that up because I want you to know that I endorse you and what you're doing.
Reagan set in motion a political realignment that shapes presidential politics to this day by uniting three very different conservative constituencies under the GOP tent. Big business Republicans, the newly ascended Christian right, and so-called Reagan Democrats, working-class men of the Rust Belt and Heartland, whose fathers would never have dreamed of voting Republican. The result was a crushing 2-1 margin of victory with white male voters in the 1980 election, and the first major gender gap in American presidential politics, one that would help earn Reagan 2 terms and shape American politics for decades to come.
Where is it written that we must act if we do not care, as if we're not moved? Well, I am moved. I want a kinder and gentler nation.
Vice President George H.W. Bush had an image problem, the wimp factor. Although once the youngest American fighter pilot in World War II, not to mention former director of the CIA, Poppy, as he was affectionately known, had difficulty shaking his aristocratic, Northeastern Ivy League background, which newer members of the party viewed as effete and even effeminate. With the epicenter of the Republican Party moving south and west, and its electoral base becoming more populist, the party was seeking more pugilistic candidates. Fortunately for Bush, his Democratic opponent, former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, was a cerebral, technocratic leader who never seemed to fully grasp the symbolic aspect of the presidency. He was also a man who wanted nothing to do with cheap ceremonial displays of patriotism and masculine bravado. In the summer of 1988, Dukakis held a sizable 17-point lead over Bush in the polls. But that was before Bush's political strategist Lee Atwater, with the help of media consultant Roger Ailes, went to work.
What does Dukakis do? He's a hypocrite. We all know that. You know it too. That is reflective of the kind of out-of-touch crowd they are. They probably sat up in Brookline eating Belgium endives and a quiche out of the can.
Atwater would orchestrate a strategy that would soon become standard practice in conservative politics and media, positioning Republicans as tough guys while ridiculing the manhood of Democrats.
He thinks that a naval exercise is something you find in Jane Fonda's workout book.
The 1988 race produced one of the most infamous TV ads in political history.
Bush and Dukakis on crime.
Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times.
The ad wasn't just colored with the kind of racist dog whistles that conservatives have been relying on since Nixon. It also sent a clearly gendered message that Dukakis was a failed protector who wasn't man enough to be trusted to safeguard law-abiding white citizens. Then came two fatal self-inflicted wounds. The first, immortalized as one of the worst campaign photo ops ever, was Dukakis's failed attempt to display his toughness with a ride in an Abrams battle tank. The reaction from the press corps in attendance said it all. As writer Stephen Ducott observed, instead of the formidable, battle-hardened leather neck he wished to present himself as, Dukakis looked more like a frightened four-year-old boy on his first bumper car ride, something Lee Atwater and other Bush operatives were only too willing to exploit. Running a devastating ad that ridiculed Dukakis' manhood and counter his efforts to challenge bloated Republican military budgets.
And now he wants to be our commander-in-chief. America can't afford that risk.
The second self-inflicted wound would come in the form of a question during the debates.
Governor, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime.
Dukakis's measured and rational response to his wife's hypothetical rape and murder only reinforced the perception of him as an inadequate protector and not tough enough for the job. Bush ended up with 63% of the white male vote and trounced Dukakis in a 40-state landslide. A message was being sent loud and clear to white men that a real man wouldn't even consider voting for a Democrat.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. Next up is The Bike Show.
Good day and welcome to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming at kbo.fm. All shows are also archived at www.bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. Our engineer today is Ty Walker. I hope the fall season started well for